Tonight I'm going to talk about something that people think that philosophers talk about all the time, but which philosophers actually don't talk about very much, at least not nowadays. That's the question of what life is all about. I will first sketch out a possible answer to that question that is very commonly accepted in our society, even if almost no one formulates it explicitly. Second, I will sketch out a key competitor to that view. This competitor is roughly the view proposed by the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle. Third, I will complicate things a bit by drawing on the Catholic theological and spiritual tradition to raise questions about the Aristotelian answer. In the end, I won't claim to have settled the question of what life is all about. That's way too much for a 40-minute talk. But perhaps I will have made it clearer what some of the issues are and what a good solution might look like. First, then, there's a certain attitude towards life that I think is now quite common in our society. I call it feelings management. According to feelings management, the task of living consists in managing your feelings so that on balance, they're as positive as they can be. I have chosen the word feelings on purpose to cover not only emotions, but also physical sensations. Feelings management is concerned with both. In fact, figuring out how they are related is a crucial task for feelings management. For example, running a marathon is pretty unpleasant, but having run a marathon gives you a sense of accomplishment, bragging rights, and so on. For some people, the negative sensations of pain and fatigue involved in running the race just don't outweigh the positive emotions at the end, while for others, they do. And of course, you don't just have to balance out physical sensations against emotions, you also have to balance physical sensations against other physical sensations and emotions against other emotions. It's very complicated. Feelings management is about somehow juggling your physical sensations and your emotions in such a way that overall, you end up feeling as good as possible. I think that for a lot of people, trying to live a good life means being a good feelings manager. You try to avoid feeling physical pain, but perhaps a little physical pain is a price worth paying for the sake of being healthier. You enjoy your successes, but you try to avoid gloating over them, because when others feel bad in comparison, you end up feeling guilty. You try to avoid feeling guilty, but maybe a little bit of guilt helps spur you on to accomplish something satisfying. Through all of this, the ultimate test is how it makes you feel. Now, perhaps here I should insert a clarification. Sometimes the way something feels to you is a legitimate factor to consider. For me, wearing a size 8 shoe would hurt quite a lot. And that's a pretty good reason for me to wear a different size. If you need to relax by doing something fun, you should pick something that actually is fun, something that's fun for you. So when I talk about feelings management, I don't mean the mere fact of sometimes basing decisions on our feelings. I don't mean picking ice cream flavors based on what you like and what you don't like. I mean treating all of life as if it were a trip to the ice cream store. Feelings management is when we view the whole of life solely through the lens of how things make us feel. Now notice, when I first gave the example of running a marathon, I noted that running a marathon seems to be a good choice for some feelings managers, but a bad choice for others. What works for you might not work for me, because not everyone feels the same way about everything. So to the extent that we think about life using the principles of feelings management, to that extent, we will lean towards relativism. That is, towards the view that there isn't an absolute standard of what makes actions good or bad, or of what makes a life good or bad. Well, that's moral relativism. If decisions and life choices are supposed to be made on the basis of how they make us feel, then there's no reason to expect there to be moral standards that hold for everyone. Even if there are standards that hold for most people most of the time, inasmuch as those standards lead to good feelings for most people most of the time, it seems plausible that there will be a few people out there for whom deviating from those standards will feel really great. Most of us don't like torturing cats, but maybe it's a real thrill for that rare person. And this, I will mention in passing, would seem to be a weakness in the moral thinking of one of philosophy's most prominent feelings managers, namely David Hume, who seems not to have worried much about the possibility that acting for pleasure might lead some people to seriously base actions. It's not merely that feelings management as a life strategy seems to entail moral relativism as a matter of logic. It's also that feelings management makes moral relativism attractive and desirable. If a certain moral principle is too challenging, if I keep failing and feeling guilty, or if adhering to it means I'll have to miss out on pleasures that I'm unwilling to give up, then I can just say that the moral principle isn't true for me. Moral relativism is great for minimizing and even eliminating guilt, which is a very unpleasant feeling. If, on the other hand, I like behaving in a certain way, then maybe I will decide that this way of acting is right for me. Once I've decided that, I will feel even better about that kind of action, and I will be more likely to persist in doing it. So moral relativism is attractive to feelings managers. I have described feelings management as an approach to life, and I have showed that it goes well with moral relativism. Let me now add that it goes well with other kinds of relativism. Sometimes people say things like this: maybe God exists for you, but he doesn't exist for me. On reflection, there's something extremely bizarre about such statements. If the word God is being used correctly here, then it's extremely difficult to see how God's existence or non-existence could vary from person to person. Whether God exists or doesn't exist, surely it's the same for everyone. Nonetheless, people do say things like that. Why? Here's my suggestion. Thoughts about God affect some people's feelings in a pretty strong way. Sometimes positively, sometimes negatively. That makes thoughts about God prime candidates for feelings management. Perhaps some people use God and religion in general as part of their toolkit for feelings management. Believing in God, praying, and engaging in certain religious rituals gives certain people a sense of mission, a sense of consolation, and so forth. Other people, by contrast, find religion really stressful. It's boring, and when it's not boring, it's threatening. For these people, God and religion are not helpful parts of a toolkit for feelings management. So when people say God exists for me, maybe what they mean is that believing in God is helpful as part of their strategy for feelings management. And when people say God doesn't exist for me, maybe what they mean is that believing in God is not helpful to them as part of their strategy for feelings management. Maybe they even mean that disbelieving in God is helpful for them. The point I'm getting at here is that feelings management fits well not just with moral relativism, but also with relativism about the very nature of reality, relativism about what exists and what doesn't exist. I've given the example of belief in God, but it's not the only thing that this might apply to. Consider the question of whether there is a fixed human nature. Some people find this helpful, so they say it's true for them, while others don't, so they say it's not true for them. If this is right, then it's interesting to note that somehow, for feelings managers, you don't believe things because you think they're true. You believe things because doing so helps you feel better. Different things give different people different feelings. And so we end up in a further and deeper kind of relativism, a relativism not just about right and wrong, but about how the world is. I presume you can tell that I'm not a big fan of relativism or of feelings management. If I had a lot of time, maybe I could lay out some reasons for rejecting them. Not that we should assume that it would be particularly easy. Deep philosophical issues are very hard to argue about. Usually, the way you try to settle a dispute is by appealing to a deeper principle. For example, you can sometimes settle a dispute in engineering by appealing to some principles of chemistry or physics. But in philosophy, pretty much by definition, you are trying to get as close to the foundations as you can. At a certain point, you can't appeal to principles any deeper than the ones that you are considering because you've already hit the foundation. This doesn't mean that there's no truth about the matter, and it doesn't mean that the truth can't be discovered, but it does mean that making progress is very difficult. I think we're now close to being at that sort of point. So instead of arguing against relativism and against feelings management, I'm just going to set them aside and move in a different direction. I'm going to take it as granted that there's something implausible about them, and I'm going to explore alternatives. The first, which you could call the human flourishing view, is pretty much the view found in Aristotle. The basic idea is this. For every type of living organism, there are things that count as doing well and other things that count as not doing well. The Oxford philosopher Philippa Foot called this natural goodness. If you're a squirrel, then these are some things that belong to doing well. Having four legs, not being eaten by a hawk, gathering a lot of nuts, making baby squirrels. Relativism makes no sense for talking about squirrels. Having only three legs is bad for a squirrel, and so is being eaten by a hawk. Failing to gather nuts is bad, and so is going baby squirrelless. Now, of course, there are complications here. For example, losing a leg is bad for a squirrel, but it might be a legitimate price to pay for something else, such as escaping from a trap. For our purposes here, getting into those sorts of details isn't necessary. What's important to focus on is that there are good and bad ways for squirrel lives to go. Squirrels can flourish, and they can fail to flourish. Flourishing is good, and not flourishing is bad. Well, human beings are living organisms too. And so not just for squirrels, but also for us, there's a difference between what counts as flourishing and what doesn't. As with squirrels, relativism doesn't make good sense. Having the right number of legs is good for us. Being struck by a car isn't. So far, that sounds a lot like squirrels, but humans are different because we have reason and free will. So for humans, flourishing means not just having good things happen to us, and not just doing things properly by instinct, the way a squirrel gathers nuts, but also, and especially, making good decisions and using our reason well. So a flourishing human life is a life in which humans use reason well in order to make intelligent choices that promote the flourishing of our kind of organism. Eating well, getting exercise, raising our children, being true to our friends, all of these contribute to human life going well. Further, since we can choose these things through reason and free will, we are responsible for what happens in a way that squirrels can't be. And therefore, it makes sense to speak in terms of praise and blame, moral goodness and badness. Aristotle has a word for the life lived well, eudaimonia, which is...
Here, write it on the board.
Yeah. Which can be translated as happiness or blessedness. He defines it as the activity of the soul according to virtue throughout a whole life. It's not merely the capacity for living and acting, but the actualization of that capacity. That's why it's the activity of the soul. It's not just any old way of living and acting, but living and acting according to virtue or excellently, which for humans means according to reason. And it's not just having a good day, but something that characterizes a whole life or as much of it as possible. Given that we started with feelings management, it seems appropriate to say something about Aristotle's views on what a good life feels like. For Aristotle, it's pleasurable to use our powers. It's more pleasurable to use them well, and it's more pleasurable still to use them on the best objects. It's fun to look at things. It's more fun to look at them carefully, and it's funnest when the things we're looking at are beautiful. So generally speaking, good activities are enjoyable activities. Well, if life is, in a sense, a big, complex activity, then a life lived well will be a pleasurable life. And this is what Aristotle says. So while pleasure doesn't show up in his official definition of happiness, nonetheless, he holds that pleasure emerges from excellent activity as its natural completion. A life that is happy or blessed, in his sense, will be an enjoyable one, unless perhaps some horrible events happen to mar our happiness, which, of course, that does happen. A good life feels good, but that doesn't mean for Aristotle that everything that feels good is good. He wouldn't say, as we sometimes do, that your feelings are your feelings, as if that settles things. He says, rather, that we need to be taught to feel pleasure and pain in the right way, for the right things. And he says that if we take pleasure in bad things, then that pleasure is bad. This might suggest that someone could live a very enjoyable life while being a bad person. But I think that's not really Aristotle's view. In the short run, sure, we can enjoy bad actions. But in the long run, the inner contradictions between our actions and our nature as humans will emerge. Aristotle says that in the long run, a bad person does not enjoy his life. He doesn't like the kind of person that he has become, and he is, so to speak, unable to be a friend to himself. It's as if he can't stand his own company. From Aristotle's point of view, then, the point of life is to live in a way that best actualizes human nature. Morality is a matter of flourishing. Good actions are those in which we succeed in actualizing ourselves in the right way. Bad actions are those in which we fail to actualize ourselves in the right way. Those in which we fail to flourish, whether through harming others or through harming ourselves, or usually both. A good life will be pleasant for the person living it, and a bad life will be unpleasant for the person living it. If Aristotle is right, then, feelings management is the wrong approach. The goal of life isn't to feel good. The goal of life is to live well. In the long run, the feeling good part will probably take care of itself, but it's not what we should be aiming for. Interestingly, this seems to line up to some extent with what psychologists nowadays call the paradox of pleasure. People who aim at pleasure often miss it, while people who aim at doing things well have a pretty good time. So that's a rough look at Aristotle's view of what life is about. It's not about managing our feelings, but about living excellently. I think this view makes a lot of sense. It connects to our natures as living organisms, and at the same time it highlights what is distinctively human, namely reason. It makes clear why living for pleasure is beneath us, and yet it finds an appropriate place for pleasure. Nonetheless, I think it has to be said that from the Christian point of view, this Aristotelian vision is seriously incomplete. According to Christianity, we can, by God's free gift of grace, live a higher kind of life than the one Aristotle envisions. Supernatural infusion of a divine gift makes it possible for us to live on a supernatural plane, to love God above all things and to love things other than God, insofar as they are in accord with God's will for us, and thereby ultimately to live in a way that is worthy in God's sight. This is emphatically not a case of natural goodness, but of supernatural goodness. It's brought about by divine grace acting on our nature, healing it from sin, and raising it up. Now, explaining the relationship between the goodness of our nature and the goodness we receive through grace is a very tricky task. It's one of the toughest theological problems, and a lot of disputes have arisen over it. For our purposes here, I think it's adequate to just keep our eye on the idea that whatever the precise relation between nature and grace is, the natural actualization of our natural capacities isn't enough for true and full human fulfillment. Let me say that again. From the Christian standpoint, living according to natural goodness isn't enough. What counts as the best way to live will look different for Christians. The good life, as imagined by Hume, the poor man, or even Aristotle, will be different from the good life as imagined by Aquinas or other Christians. But different how? One way of thinking about it might be as follows. Philosophical natural ethics discovers the proper form of human natural goodness, and Christianity adds on some extras. Stuff about prayer and worship and so on. In other words, this way of thinking says that supernatural goodness takes natural goodness as it is and then adds some supernatural stuff to it. But another way of thinking, more radical perhaps, would say that human natural goodness is at least to some extent in tension with supernatural goodness, so that if we want to attain to supernatural goodness, we have to give up on some natural goodness in favor of something even better. It's not an easy question. But whether or not Christianity's vision of a supernatural spiritual life is in tension with a true and perfectly correct understanding of human natural goodness, Christianity's vision is certainly in tension with the understanding of human natural goodness that people usually have. Even if, in some theoretical sense, the gospel isn't in tension with philosophical ethics, it's certainly going to be in tension with ethics as they are commonly understood in practice. The gospel always challenges us on questions of sex, on questions of material wealth and consumption, on questions having to do with the use of force, and on. If our society's instincts match those of the gospel in some respects, they will fail to match it in others. Given our fallen nature, we should feel confident that without the guidance of Christian teaching, we will get at least some things wrong. Now let's talk about feelings again. First, if our views about what is good and bad in human life are likely to be off target unless we have correction from the gospel, then so presumably will our feelings. Aristotle was more right than he knew. Aristotle was more right than he knew when he said, as mentioned earlier, that we need to learn to feel pleasure and pain in the right way. For example, in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, Jesus says, big quote now, "You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you salute only your brethren, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? I find it hard to escape the thought that Christ here is talking not merely about showing love to enemies on the level of outward actions, although obviously that's very important, but also about feeling well disposed towards them, even if we should still hate the things that they do. He's talking, I think, about re-educating our feelings away from what seems natural and normal to human beings to something that is more divine. Indeed, the very next verse is, quote, "You therefore must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect." And let's face it, a re-education of our feelings won't be fun or easy. We'll have to learn to stop enjoying some things we currently enjoy, and to enjoy things we currently don't enjoy, or at least put up with them. This business about loving our enemies is only one example. The gospel might call us to take less enjoyment in consumer goods, or to walk away from certain kinds of impure sexual relations, or simply to focus less on that person whom we all find so incredibly fascinating, namely oneself. Coming to live in a Christian way will surely bring joy in the long run, but there's no special reason to think that it will always be fun in the short run. Now I want to make a second remark about feelings. This one is tougher to get right, and it leads into deep waters. I certainly don't speak with confidence, but anyway, here goes. In the Christian tradition, there's an important role given not only to joy, but also to suffering, and also an important role given to something that is neither suffering nor rejoicing, but just plain blahness. Dryness, or aridity, is what it is usually called. In spite of what Aristotle says about the way in which pleasure naturally follows upon virtuous activity, it seems to be part of the Christian spiritual tradition to say that suffering or aridity can play a role in our growing closer to God. Is that word aridity, does that make any sense? Like arid, you know? Hmm? Yeah. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it in a way that's making... Consider the fact that we all have attachments to created things, and that sometimes those attachments are inappropriate. We tend to love things regardless of whether God wants us to. That's a problem in itself, and it creates the danger that sometimes we'll love things even when God wants us not to. The world is good and beautiful, but it's also a kind of trap. Like children on their birthday, we sometimes love the gifts more than the giver. So when things we used to enjoy become flat and uninspiring, or when life hits a crisis and we go through a period of suffering, this can be an opportunity for God to wean us from these attachments. It's a chance for us to learn how to live and act more purely for God alone. For example, maybe prayer or serving one's neighbor used to result in excitement or joy, but now it doesn't so much anymore. We might be tempted to say here, "Ah, I'm losing my faith. I don't love God anymore," and things like that. But that only makes sense if the true test is how we feel. Maybe it isn't the true test. Instead of giving up, we can keep praying. We can keep serving others, and so on. And now, we'll be doing it in a more disinterested way. Whereas before, we might have been motivated, at least in part, by the pleasure we get from prayer and service. The fact that the pleasure has faded gives us a chance to go deeper. Deeper than feelings. Of course, it's reasonable to hope that joy will return later in a deeper way. And this up and down process might happen any number of times. But the point is that, again, one comes through God's grace to operate on a level deeper than feelings. Desire for God isn't necessarily the same as having warm, positive feelings about God. True desire can carry on even when we just aren't feeling it, to use that expression. If this is right, then the relation between feeling good and living well is more complicated than Aristotle saw. Difficult times of dryness or suffering, might not mean that anything is going wrong. Maybe it's a chance to learn how to love God in a less self-centered way. Let me add that when this is happening, God has not abandoned us, even if sometimes we might feel like that. God is still supporting us, and we can be confident that he will continue to give us the graces and consolations we need to remain faithful to our calling. If we remain true in prayer and service, God won't leave us behind. This question about how we feel about God can be looked at from another perspective. God is not just another being in this world whom we can perceive with our senses or grasp with our mind. He is utterly transcendent, totally over the horizon in the deepest sense possible. When we feel excitement or consolation in prayer and service, that might lead us to think that God is part of the world, just another being that we can come to terms with. If falling into this error is a danger for us, I suppose it's a danger for everybody, then it might be good for us if God somehow withdraws from us or hides from us. Perhaps that's a way for him to reveal to us just how different he is. And also, a way for him to provoke us into pursuing him more ardently. This point has been emphasized by the writer Donald Haggerty, a priest of the Archdiocese of New York, who has had a long association with Mother Teresa's order. Father Haggerty says that when Jesus was a boy, hide and seek must have been his favorite game. And as you may know, Mother Teresa herself went through long periods of feeling abandoned by God. Throughout, she stayed faithful in prayer, and also she stayed faithful in extremely generous works of charity. All of this is not easy to understand or to accept. That's especially the case for us today, I think. We live in a society whose dominant model of life is feelings management, so we're all affected by it. According to that model, times of dryness and suffering are just to be avoided. What's more, we live in a society which is designed to keep us constantly stimulated. In fact, most people now carry in their pockets a very complicated high-tech device whose main purpose is to get them to focus on enjoyable trivialities. I mean, think about it. Maybe we need to put the phone away and spend more time with others face to face. Even more importantly, maybe we need to spend more time alone in silent prayer. If we do this, we'll quickly come face to face with boredom and other unpleasant things. But maybe that's good. Maybe we need to find out what St. Augustine taught us, that our hearts are restless until they rest in God. Thank you.
We have a time for questions and answers, so if anybody has any questions, please go ahead.
Or objections.
Well, a lot of people seem to think that, for the length of the talk, a lot of people seem to think that not being a Christian, not you know, just sort of managing their feelings leads them to have very happy lives. Like, you look at people who seem to be, you know, they're wealthy, they're educated, they're refined, they, and they don't push themselves in any of the sort of areas of tension. They sort of manage their feelings. Is there Aristotle's picture of somebody who does that, where they end up kind of being self-hating because they're not noble? Or something like that.
Well,
is there wrong to think of them as successful or as flourishing?
I think the people that Aristotle thinks of as ultimately self-hating, they aren't merely sort of worldly people. They're bad people. I don't know whether I should call somebody out. But like he's a very public figure. Hugh Hefner died a while ago. And I read a little news article. And you kind of wonder, like, do people enjoy being Hugh Hefner? Well, I just read a very brief description, which I'm not going to describe, of how he sort of kept himself entertained near the very end of his life. And it's just so horrible and depressing sounding. I thought, man, that guy was not enjoying it. But that's not, when Aristotle was talking about that, he's thinking about people who are bad, not somebody who is sort of good in a worldly way. That's a really important question. I don't have a very firm answer on it. Is it a live human possibility to just sort of live in a worldly way, but not bad, and basically enjoy it and you're not too miserable? I think empirically you have to say yeah. There's a famous case of this. Okay, this is the third mention now of David Hume, a very worldly philosopher. And Samuel Johnson, you know, the dictionary Samuel Johnson guy, who was a conflicted but very serious Christian, was appalled and angered by Hume's sort of total a-religiosity and whatnot. And he said, you wait, you'll see, when he's on his deathbed, then we'll find out. But by all accounts, Hume died very serenely. Hume thought, you know, I'll be dead soon, and then when I'm dead, I won't exist. And when I don't exist, it's not going to bother me, because I won't be there to suffer, which is like an old Epicurean teaching. And he didn't freak out. Now, of course, other people find the thought of death upsetting and terrifying. Like the poet Philip Larkin. I don't know if anybody knows Philip Larkin's poetry. Okay. So I don't know. This is a good question. I think it's a real human possibility that you can basically enjoy your life. So I didn't mean to be saying that you can tell by how miserable life is without Christianity that Christianity must be true. I was just saying if you look at Aristotle's view from the Christian point of view, it looks inadequate. Because if you look at it from the Christian point of view, you already believe that there's the supernatural level. But how you would convince Aristotle of that? If he says, look, I'm having a good time, I enjoy being noble, you know, I'm better than most people, and it's fine. You know, could you say to him, no, but deep down you're unhappy? I don't know. I think some people probably deep down are unhappy, but I wouldn't want to tell people, oh, you're unhappy. I'm not sure. Am I addressing your question?
That's
at all?
Exactly what I was going to ask.
Yeah, it's a difficult question. Do I sort of suspect that I suspect that some people are probably a little less happy than they think they are. Also, maybe it's not so much that they're unhappy, it's just that their life is smaller. So there were times in their life, maybe there still are times in their life, when they sort of catch a glimpse, there's a lot more than this. There's just a lot more than eating really nice dinner and having really nice wine. There's stuff. But then they're like, whoa, do I really want to go there? And there's a way you could just sort of close that door and go back to enjoying things the way they are. I think that's a real possibility. That's a very tough question. Mm-hmm.
Person like Aristotle wouldn't have even had the concept of a personal God, which you get in Christianity.
Yeah.
So those kind of questions back to him make it moot.
Yeah. I mean, Aristotle certainly believes in God, but his way of thinking, and his God is a person, but he's not what we would call a personal God. On the most straightforward reading, Aristotle's God doesn't even know that anything exists other than God. I mean, I know it sounds funny, but if you were God, what would you do? And the right answer to that question is you would do the best thing you could do. And that's thinking. That's the best activity. Now, what's the best version of thinking? It's to think about the best thing. So, and who's the best thing? It's God. It's not his fault. It's not like he's, like, bragging. He just is the best thing. So he eternally thinks about himself. And Aristotle says that sounds so great. Like, Aristotle says, doesn't say, what a jerk. Why doesn't he think about us? He says, that sounds amazing and wonderful. I wish I could think about God all the time. You know, he gets to do it. But what you're saying is right, right? It's not like God, like, he's thinking about us and he loves us and stuff like that. So that kind of, there is a kind of, this sort of awestruck thought about what God is and what God is like. That's part of Aristotle's philosophy, but it's not like...
The culture he was in was more stratified than this particular culture that we're in terms of he had privilege where slaves didn't.
Yeah. Well, then,
so
yeah, it was...
They were human beings,
yes.
But they were in the picture.
That's... Yeah, I mean... There's a lot of complications, but that's right. No, I mean, certainly he had a very stratified society, and his... Yeah, I mean, what Aristotle thinks about those very lowly people, those aren't always his best moments.
So, you know, one of the points you made with the Christian perspective is that there's this kind of value of suffering. So I kind of see, I mean, maybe I'm not as familiar with Aristotle, but, you know, I imagine that, that might show up in some of his thinking. So, you know, it's kind of the Greek way of, not the goal is kind of self-restraint and mastery over maybe some of the your basest instincts. There's this kind of asceticism that's attached to that.
Yeah.
Is there a distinction there? Or
well, for Aristotle, if you're very successful in this, a lot depends. He really emphasized this a lot. So much depends on how you're brought up. If you're just brought up in a terrible way, in a terrible society, and all of a sudden at the age of 30 you go, whoa, I would like to become an excellent human being, it's pretty late to be starting on that, you know? And if you've ever, like, you look at your office and you're 40 years old and you're like, this is a mess, I should be tidy. Well, it's really hard to change your habits. Not that that's a personal example. Okay, so you have to be brought up well, and then at a certain point you have to, like, take it in hand yourself, right? Now, if you're very successful at that, you won't be struggling anymore. Your passions, your feelings, your desires, all of that stuff will be conformed to reason. And his sort of model of a virtuous person, there's a lot of inner harmony, and he doesn't struggle. So when he does the right thing, he enjoys doing the right thing. Think of, like, people that you know, maybe, who are really good at being hosts. They're just really hospitable. And so you go over to their place, and they let you in, they smile, they say, can I take your coat, can I get you? And you can tell they're not, like, doing this because they have to. They just love doing this. Right, so they have the virtue of hospitality, and if they really have it, they don't overdo it either, right? Because if overdoing it is another way of being inhospitable, right? So, so when you're young, you have to overcome these things, but when you've really got it together, it's not a matter of overcoming anymore for Aristotle. Does that help? I mean,
I guess the distinction then is. In the Christian perspective, I guess you never quite reach that.
I think that's right. And, yeah, I think that for Christianity, it's typically held that you're never really done that job, right? And this is why a lot of the saints are always telling you how bad they are. Because they see, it's not actually that they're like running around murdering people, but their standards just keep rising and rising and rising. But then there's this other sort of more mysterious thing that maybe troubles enter your life, and maybe that's sort of now a new opportunity to grow closer to God.
You talked about aridity. And I was wondering if you think that, that developing patience through periods of aridity maybe applies to a lot of things in life.
Keep going.
And especially other relationships.
Mm-hmm.
As someone who's been married 48 years, there are relationships that... that are certainly, besides the relationship with God, that are going to have periods of aridity. And I think that
no, that's right.
Maybe this is one of the dangers of young people living together without a commitment. It was because then they hit a period of aridity.
Yes.
And they say, I'm just not feeling this anymore.
Right.
And rather than having the patience and the commitment to work on it, that's why.
Yeah, no, I see that. I'm thinking of a couple that I know who have been married 50 some odd years. And they had a bad patch in their marriage. And it was like, when I say a bad patch, I'm talking like 15 years or more. But they don't even, like, you can't really learn about this from them. You have to talk to other people because they don't even remember it. They're that far past it now. But yeah, it would have been a lot easier to walk away. And there's just a lot of, I mean, I don't mean to be like distracting attention from your example, but I want to say, like, even more broadly, think of studying, right? Like most of us study, well, most of us, many people, probably everyone here, studied the things that they wanted to study. But it's sometimes you just hit a point where it's not that much fun.
Actually,
at least for now.
Broaden the example.
Yeah, okay, yeah. You just hit a point where it's just not fun. Now you could quit or you could keep going. And being able to do things when they're not fun anymore is important. That's why there's a number of reasons why, but this business about finding your passion, I don't really like that advice. Because if you're always, it's not always going to be there for you. I know maybe there are a few weird people and every day they're passionate. Good. Like, great. I wish I were the person. But like, no, most people aren't. And you have to learn how to just deal with just doing it. I mean, that's the difference between acting according to your will and acting according to your feelings. The will is a rational appetite. So it's pulled along primarily by what reason tells you is good. You do it because you think it's good, not because you have this feeling of pleasure from it.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about some of these apparent complications between like a Christian ethics and an Aristotelian ethics. It seems like an Aristotelian ethics, like this concept of eudaimonia is based kind of around like virtue and like practicing human functions. In a way that elevates like the unique human function to contemplate.
Yes.
In that sense, if you took like the example of a human person who was like successfully spending a maximum amount of time and most fruitfully like contemplating, but not feeling any kind of joy or even like kind of intellectual joy in that, like would Aristotle call that like a life of eudaimonia?
Okay, so I don't know, just in case the question didn't make it onto the thing, if Aristotle thought of someone who was sort of maximally performing the highest human activity of contemplation, thinking, true theoretical thoughts about the highest things, but they didn't enjoy it, what would he say about that? Would that count as a happy life? I could answer that in a, I mean, in one way it fits the definition, right? But on the other hand, for Aristotle, there's something like, there's a sense in which that's not supposed to happen, because it's natural for pleasure to sort of ride piggyback on good and successful activities. So, if someone is performing the activity really well, but they're not enjoying it, then something's gone wrong. Now, maybe there's just something wrong with them. I mean, that's something you could say, I guess. Or maybe something has interfered with the activity and tainted it. So, for example, I know somebody who... I know, he, like in high school, he played squash and tennis and stuff like that. And he knew some other kids who were better than he at tennis, and they'd like gone off to these tennis camps, and they'd become amazingly good at tennis. And it was a marvel to him how good they were, and it was also a marvel to him how much they hated it. Because their parents and their coaches had driven them so hard, it had just been spoiled. But he was like, whoa, if I played the way you played, I would love it, right? Okay, but the thing is, I think in that case, that looks like a counterexample to Aristotle's idea, but maybe it isn't, because the thing is, it's been tainted by these other things that are interfering. But all other things being equal, an activity performed successfully on a good object is supposed to be pleasurable. So I think he would say that it's, if you have that activity and it wasn't pleasurable, then something unnatural is happening. Does that help?
Yeah, I guess I just wonder if by, like, you know, like applying very rigorously this definition in Aristotelian ethics, like, you can actually much more easily accommodate, like, periods of spiritual...
Oh, I see. Yeah, I mean, if you just stick to the definition and just sort of push aside the other stuff that Aristotle says about pleasure completing the activities, in a way it makes it easier to say these things. That's probably right. At that point, you're sort of deviating somewhat from Aristotle himself. Because, yeah, I mean, well, for reasons that are obvious, right? But that's true. You could sort of say, well, let's just forget what Aristotle said about pleasure and just focus on the definition even more than he did. I think, that's an interesting project. You could sort of, it's not quite a pure Aristotle, but that's all right. I mean, Aristotle is just a great example, maybe the greatest example of a philosopher that people think about and develop in their own ways. We mentioned Thomas Aquinas already. If you look out the window here, one of the names on that building over there is Averroes, an evil Muslim philosopher. Very, very different version of Aristotle than Aquinas is. So there's a lot of Aristotles out there. So you have a sort of a aridity of Aristotle.
I think we have time for one more question, if anybody else has one.
Mm-hmm.
Professor, thank you for the excellent talk. In the last part of the talk, you told us about this purification of feelings that God sometimes wants, and kind of indifference or maybe independence of the feelings. Would you call that a kind of Christian version of Stoicism?
Oh, that's a good question. Is it a Christian version of Stoicism? Oh, I'm really scared to answer that question. There was a Stoic influence on some of the early Christian monastic tradition. Some of the language and the concepts that they use sound like that. They use the same technical terminology and whatnot. Now, why do I not want to just say yes? Maybe I'll say yes for a kind of wimpy way. I'm not sure that I feel, now the more I think about it, I'm starting to wonder, do I know enough about Stoicism to be confident about that, right? So the sort of potted version you get about Stoicism is that, this ideal that they always have is apatheia, right? which you could just transliterate, just like write the words as if they were, and it's apathy, right? So it's the philosophy of apathy. Well, right away you have to know that can't really be what they mean, right? Because like in English, apathy means just not caring. So, but you could call it passionlessness or being dispassionate. Now, I think for them, see, it depends on how you take this. One way to think about it is that passion is now being used as a somewhat of a technical term. It means bad passions. So you're free of bad passions. Well, if passion, by definition, right? So if you enjoy feeding the poor, that's not a passion, because we're now using it in a technical sense, right? Or you can think about it in this other way. So I'm stumbling around. I don't know. I don't know enough about Stoicism, and I want to think about that more. I just sort of have like the textbook Stoicism, and I'm now feeling how inadequate that is. But there is, in certain respects, on a sort of practical level, there's sometimes a sort of kinship between certain Christian themes and Stoic themes. I mean, you know, like in Stoicism, they appear to deny free will, blah blah blah, and you go, okay, well that can't be Christianity. But in sort of practical terms, how you're supposed to live, you can read like Stoic writings and go, wow, that's great, you know. So it does have a kind of ascetical feeling, this sort of sense of trying to figure out the real purpose of the universe and align yourself with that purpose, and not be concerned with your own feelings and your own desires and what's in it for me, because I get myself in line with the whole universe. That's a Stoic way of thinking, and it jives in certain ways with Christianity. Of course, the Christian God is a personal God. He's not a sort of impersonal logos, the impersonal sort of word or thought. It's more personal and it's more individualized. So there are important differences too. But Stoicism is a kind of kin to Christianity in a way that other things aren't. Okay. Did I get through that?
Great, thank you.